I'm hoping this week to continue where we left off last week, really, because just to have a bit of a pricey of last week's stuff, only 5 minutes or so, just to bring anybody up to speed that wasn't here on Emmanuel Velikovsky and his worlds in collision, and the several successful predictions he made regarding the nature and composition of Venus and Jupiter and Earth's moon, that despite this, despite his successful predictions, his looking with his intellect and reason at several inexplicable problems and enigmas that were presented to him from the past, coming to conclusions about them and being able to make some sort of projection as to what might be found by space probes that go out and have a look at the planets and moons. And his way of working led him to make several very surprising predictions, I think most of which, there's one or two that haven't, but most of which have turned out, as far as we can tell, to be correct. Despite all of this, the theories on which he based his predictions were rejected by orthodoxy as irrational, and he was shunned by his peers. What actually happened there was specifically that the Doubleday, who were the people who published Worlds in Collision, suddenly saw an embargo placed on them by all their other scientific writers who refused to put forward any more work for publishing unless Velikovsky was removed from the list, which he was. We'll hear later on that Doubleday are now once again publishing some pretty revolutionary stuff, so perhaps they learned their lesson there. And it does have to be said, really, that as well as Velikovsky being pretty much on the mark in terms of all sorts of bizarre things that he's taken up against the flow, the establishment scientists were then, and still do, as far as I can see, profess what could only be described as sustained and repeated surprise at what, to them, are nearly always deeply unexpected results. It's a most uncanny thing that the people who are wrapping all the equations in lumps of metal and shooting it into space to stare at things and send back results and stuff should be so deeply misplaced in the predictions they're making that they more often have to express surprise than satisfaction. We talked a little bit about Velikovsky's basic theory, which was that the early solar system was far from stable, and that in fact it has remained occasionally unstable even in such a short period as the last 5,000 years, during which he reckons that Venus was at some point born of Jupiter as a planet-sized comet, and there was significant and energetic interchange between Venus and the Earth, which took a lot of energy out of Venus so that she adopted a more circular orbit. She's got a pretty uncanny orbit, but before that happened, Mars was pulled out of its orbit, and there was what was effectively a battle in the sky that happened over several, I think, 15-year periods between Venus and Mars, and that caused a lot of upset on Earth, some of which we might look at this evening, but fundamentally it ended with a thunderbolt, a kind of bolt of lightning, visible between Venus and Mars, which presumably pretty much finished Mars off. Up until that point, Mars had been on the other side of Earth, and in all of this, it danced around. Sorry, lost my concentration there for a moment. In this evening's show, we're going to move on a little bit and have a look at some of the implications of what travelling through the tail of a comet actually means. We're going to have a look at what Velikovsky's mind made of the biblical plagues in Exodus, because he made a really good job at talking about those. Something which I've read a lot in my time and always thought it was pretty bizarre and inexplicable, and here's a man who I think offers a pretty reasonable explanation for nearly all of it. I very much filleted just a short section of the book to look at because there's so much detail in there, but to give you some feel of it, and because really what's happening here is there's a huge opportunity to change the way we grasp so many of the symbols and archetypes that we see around us, because so many of them are involved with this actual story. And Velikovsky really starts taking a bit of a crowbar in amongst it and removing it from the extraordinary and inexplicable, and making it comprehensible, if you like, understandable in a kind of physical historical context, rather than in the deeply separate world that's been established for the Old Testament by, not only by the changing of all the names of all the places, but as we shall see, by the selective taking on of data and certain other things. But we're well used to that. We also have a quick look at some commentary that was written in, I think it was the 12th or 13th century, by a guy called Maimonides, and I swear when you hear the little section on him, you're gonna swear. I could swear I was dealing with somebody that's common purpose trained. You never heard somebody coming up with such a difficult argument to sustain in a quiet and reasonable and well-measured way. It really is, I think, one of the most remarkable parts of my journey over the last couple of weeks. We're going to look also a bit later at the latest modern theory of an electric universe, because that is exactly what Velikovsky was predicting. His biggest heresy amongst many was that he was claiming that the universe, the cosmos, and especially, and you know, particularly for us, the solar system, are not electrically neutral, that there's a huge amount of potential electrical activity between the various planets going on all the time, but changing as the state of the solar system changes. And effectively, I guess really one of the suggestions is that the celestial bodies do not actually bang into each other, not very often. What generally seems to happen, at least as far as Velikovsky and the more modern researchers are concerned, is that there's a build-up of electrical charge as the bodies get closer and closer. And there's various ways through which the poles of the charged bodies can be arranged such that there will be a pretty massive electrical discharge. But that in itself is enough to prevent one thing from actually banging into another. And so as a result, much of the stuff that we're looking at, when we're looking at these heavily gouged surfaces of moons and at the surfaces of planets, is the result of electrical activity between bodies that are passing close to each other. We're going to look at how ancient rock art appears to be intimately associated with discoveries that have been made actually in the laboratories of plasma physicists. So there's an opportunity for people to experiment and demonstrate to us that what they're talking about is at least producible in the laboratory, if not actually reproducible, of whatever it was that was going on. One of the amazing things I think that happened in all of this is just yesterday morning I received another link which actually explains a lot more about some of the stuff that I'm going to be looking at this evening. And that's really been the way of it recently, almost as fast as I can get stuff organized. The right kind of stuff and people have been turning up to keep me very busy. So, after dealing with the electric universe, we'll have a look at comets and what it is after all of the research being done, even the fact that NASA threw an 800-pound copper probe at Temple 1 and got the results and then got to go and have a look at it a while later with another probe of some sort they had spinning through the cosmos. it would appear that what they're writing, what everybody's writing on the internet, as far as I can see, top 10 or 20 results have got, haven't changed their mind one bit since 2005, 2007, 2009, whenever, way after the Wii project we're going to have a quick look at. And the last thing, I think, is to have a return to the subject of disassociative behavior in humans, because that's where this whole story started at the beginning of last week's show, was with the individual abuse of youngsters, which is the basis of trauma-based mind control, which drives personalities under the surface, personalities that can subsequently be used to the advantage of whomsoever, and that one of the characteristics of this behaviour is a difficulty to face life as it actually presents itself, because there's so much sublimated stuff, and there also is frequently a desire later in life to visit the sublimated experience onto others around you. And Velikovsky, amongst others, argues that we as a race are suffering from just such a dissociative complex, and that is why we are spending so much time damaging each other, criticizing each other, and failing to get together and recognize what it is that needs to be done. And so it is that it is said, isn't it, in the psychiatry, that what's needed in order to start fixing this is to be able to face up to and understand whatever it is that's been done to us. This is a point that's made, I think, by Velikovsky. It's made by Stan Hall. It's made again a little later in this evening stuff by Mr. Talbot, who's responsible initially for the Thunderbolts Project information that we're going to be looking at. Also, yeah, of course, later on in the show, I've just remembered that some of the talk on the Electric Universe has got some pictures from the Thunderbolts Project in the little slideshow, the slide image shower thingy that's in the TNS chat box. So if you're listening on a remote radio player and might like to come and have a look at the pictures, then get yourself booked in and stuff so that you can get administered through, or whatever it is that needs to be done. So long ago, I can't really remember. I'm going to kick off with a look at how different Velikovsky's story of the Exodus is from the story of the Exodus itself, and certainly from most of the other people that have been writing about it or commentating on it. For those who can't remember, the plagues of Exodus were broadly a plague of curses, a plague of blood. There was frogs, there was apparently lice and gnats, flies and wild animals, pestilence, boils, hail, locusts, darkness, and culminating in the plague of the firstborn. Velikovsky does, I think, cover all 10 of those things one way and the other. He manages to get them into his explanation. There's a chance that because I have, as I say, filleted the thing a little bit, there's a chance that you'll only get to hear about some of them. But in the process, it is extremely revelatory about some parts of the history of the planet, and he makes just a lot of sense about things that are currently mysterious, not just about the Bible, but about the physical nature of the Earth as well. So we talked a little bit about some of the disasters last week, but there was a bit of a prequel, if you like. And in looking at the Exodus, we start with a period about 52 years before that. I think we're talking about here something like 1600 years before the Common Era, so about 3,500 years ago or something. And he says, the pre-Columbian written traditions of Central America tell us that 52 years before the catastrophe that closely resembles that of the time of Joshua, another catastrophe of world dimensions had occurred. 52 years is, of course, a significant number in this context, because that is the major cycle of Venus, is a 52-year cycle. In other words, if you are going to encounter it at that stage, and still to a certain extent, although it's prettier, if you are going to encounter it, and then you're going to encounter it again, it'll be about 52 years later. It's therefore only natural to go back to the old Israelite traditions as narrated in the scriptures to determine whether they contain evidence of a corresponding catastrophe. This is a corresponding catastrophe to the one in Central America. In ages in chaos, Velikovsky explains that the Exodus book took place amid a great upheaval that terminated the period of Egyptian history that was known as the Middle Kingdom. And he endeavoured to show that contemporary Egyptian documents describe the same disaster accompanied by the plagues of Egypt, and that the traditions of the Arabian Peninsula relate similar occurrences in this land and on the shores of the Red Sea. And the first thing that he deals with is the Red World. In the middle of the second millennium, he says, before the present era, he intends to show that the Earth underwent one of the greatest catastrophes in its history, a celestial body that only shortly before had become a member of the solar system, a new comet, came very close to the Earth. And the account of this catastrophe can be reconstructed from evidence supplied by a large number of documents. Which is indeed the case. As he deals one by one with the various things he wants to deal with, he travels diligently around the world, telling us about many, many people who described exactly the same thing. His main interest here, though, and mine really, is just to tie up the Exodus as it came to us in the Bible with an eyewitness account that was found on a papyrus from Egypt. Because not many people have seen most of the other documents that it's necessary to study to get a full picture of this. Many of the documents disappeared. Many of them are in museums or in libraries that people can't get at. And of course, many of them are very fragile. But everybody has access, as Velikovsky says, everybody has access to the Old Testament. Everybody has access to the books of the prophets, Isaiah and Amos and the rest of them. And we know when they lived. And we know really now who the kings and people were they were talking about and where those people were being kings of. Well, one of the first visible signs of the encounter between Earth and Venus apparently was a reddening of the Earth's surface by a fine dust of rusty pigment. In sea, lake and river, this pigment gave a bloody colouring to the water. Because of these particles of ferruginous or other soluble pigment, the world turned red. The manuscript Quiche of the Mayas tells of this. It says in the Western Hemisphere, in the days of the great cataclysm, when the earth quaked and the sun's motion was interrupted, the water in the rivers turned to blood. And Velikovsky's Egyptian eyewitness, Ipua, wrote, "Plague is throughout the land, blood is everywhere." And this too obviously corresponds with the book of Exodus. There was blood throughout all the land of Egypt. The presence of the pigment in the rivers caused the death of fish, followed by decomposition and smell. And again, Exodus says, men shrink from tasting, human beings thirst after water, they say, and that is our water, that is our happiness. What shall we do in respect thereof? All is ruin. As a result of the dust and the skin of men and animals being irritated by it, there was boils and sickness and the death of cattle, a very grievous murrain it was described as. Wild animals, frightened by the portents in the sky, came close to the villages and cities, which accounts for some of the other plagues and infestations they suffered from. The Altai Tartars tell of a catastrophe when blood turns the whole world red, and a world conflagration follows. And following the red dust, which was described in the ancient texts as a small dust, like ashes of a furnace, it fell in all the land of Egypt, and then a shower of meteorites flew toward the earth. There fell a very grievous hail, such as has not been in Egypt since its foundation. The stones of Barad is the phrase preferred to hail, but it always is translated as hail when it's used. It never actually says meteorites or burning rocks or anything like that. It says hail. And this is one of the things that that is just really striking me at this most recent pass through the Bible, is how we have, it is a completely foreign text, and we basically have absolutely no way of knowing how generous or otherwise the translators have been with the sense that they originally received. And this is a cracking example that we can see from the other reports to which people don't have such easy access because they have been so widely destroyed, that hail is not an adequate word, but it is the one that is used not only here but elsewhere in the Exodus as well. We're also informed by Midrashic and Talmudic sources that the stones which fell on Egypt were hot. It really fits, only meteorites, not a hail of ice. And in the scriptures it is said that these stones fell mingled with fire, and there's a reason for that as well. And we heard last week that that actually, until 1803, science, well, nobody really believed that stones fell from the sky, even though stones had been seen falling from the sky many times before, in front, by crowds even, it was still widely believed that this didn't happen. And yet here it is, as so many other things that apparently we've forgotten about, here it is actually in the Bible being described. And if you know that hail is actually balls of fire, it makes a lot more sense. The fall of meteorites is accompanied by crashes and explosion-like noises. We know that also to be the case from things like the Tunguska explosion. We know that that was heard a very, very long way indeed from the actual centre of the explosion. And I believe that's also true of the recent Russian meteorite that came ploughing into the Earth's atmosphere. Of course, many of them, I guess, are probably travelling faster than sound, and so there may well be things like sonic booms as they arrive close to the Earth. In this case, in the case of the Exodus, the booms were so mighty that, according to the scriptural narrative, the people in the palace were terrified as much by the din of the falling stones as by the destruction they caused. And the red dust had seriously frightened people, and there was a warning to keep men and cattle under shelter, probably because of your boils and diseases and the like. Gather thy cattle and all that thou hast in the field. And he that regarded not the word of the Lord left his servants and his cattle in the field. And the word of the Lord in this case is, of course, we might safely assume it's actually the booming of the meteorites as they come in. There's other noises they make that turn out to be the word of the Lord as well as you go through it. But similarly, the Egyptian eyewitness said that cattle are left astray and there's none to gather them together. He wrote that trees are destroyed, no fruits, no herbs are found, grain has perished on every side. That has perished, which yesterday was seen. The land is left to its weariness like the cutting of a flax. In one day, fields return to a wasteland. In the book of Exodus, it's written, and the hail, or stones of Barad, smote every herb of the field and break every tree. I was wondering, last week, wondering aloud whether Buddhist texts actually covered any of this, and it appears that they do. There's one called the Visuddhimagga. Then when a world cycle is destroyed by wind, there arises a wind, and first, it raises a fine dust, and then a coarse dust, and then fine sand, and then coarse sand, and then grit, stones, up to boulders as large as mighty trees on the hilltops. All the mansions on the earth are destroyed in a catastrophe when worlds clash with worlds. The Mexicans and the North American Indians, too, remember that in some ancient epoch the sky rained not water, but fire and red-hot stones, which is not different from the Hebrew tradition. And as we said last week, the actual kind of geological and evolutionary history that has come down to us, basically through Darwin and Huxley and the like, says absolutely nothing about any of this at all. And there are people who've written about it. We heard about a man, Cuvier, last week, who was deeply puzzled by the actual nature of the geology of the planet he found himself on, and how it varied from what he'd been led to believe by his education. And perhaps it is strange that stuff which is appearing so convincingly and so conclusively in so many documents in so many places all over the world just doesn't seem to have found its way into our Orthodox canon at all. And we saw from the way Velikovsky was treated that it is still not welcome. Velikovsky reckons that the tails of comets are composed mainly of carbon and hydrogen gases, and that because they lack oxygen, they don't actually burn in flight. But the inflammable gases, when they pass through an atmosphere containing oxygen, will be set on fire. That, of course, I guess might augment your sonic boom a bit as well. If carbon and hydrogen gases or vapour of a composition of these two elements enter the atmosphere in huge masses, he reckons a part of them will burn, binding all the oxygen available at the moment, and the rest will escape combustion, but in swift transition will become liquid. And, as it turns out, the descent of a sticky fluid which came earthward and blazed with heavy smoke is recalled in the oral and written traditions of the inhabitants of both hemispheres. I don't know about you, but when I read that, that brought to mind what the Americans were doing when I was a young lad in Vietnam. They were using stuff called napalm, which was exactly that. It was exactly that. It was a sort of sticky jelly-like fluid that comes from the sky and can't be brushed off, and it burns. And that in turn made me wonder about the sublimation of some of our behaviours. I think probably, I think one of the oldest references to it, if I remember rightly, it was called St. Elmo's Fire, and was something that was used in naval battles. I'm not sure when it came about. But there you go. He reckons that hydrocarbons falling into the atmosphere that didn't combust actually ended up coming down more or less as petrol. They called it naphtha in biblical texts, or in Mesopotamia. The Popol Vuh, which is the Book of Common Things that the Maya wrote after the destruction of their books, if I remember rightly, it's a bit of a reconstruction from memory done shortly after the loss of the original materials. But that remembers that people were drowned in a sticky substance raining from the sky. The face of the earth grew dark and the gloomy rain endured for days and nights. And then there was a great din of fire above their heads. The Quiche manuscript as well, which is another Mayan one, says there, descended from the sky a rain of bitumen and of sticky substance. The earth was obscured and it rained day and night. You see, there's one of the books that has been completely transformed by my experience of reading Velikovsky. Is the Popol Vuh, or Book of Common Things, is thoroughly inscrutable. I mean, the Bible's pretty inscrutable in places, and it seems a lot more inscrutable than it appears, actually. But the Popol Vuh, it's really difficult to make any sense of it, given the kind of education we've had and stuff. But once one starts looking at this and going back to the Popol Vuh, suddenly there's a thing that was a complete mystery, which fair bit of it, say about half of it, has come to have a completely new and cleared meaning. And I can't help feeling that this kind of removal, this kind of ability to reinterpret or comprehend what was previously incomprehensible, or at least have some sort of potentially rational explanation for that which seemed to be completely inexplicable, has got to be helpful. And I think I'm kind of assuming that by changing the way these spells work, by changing the what's been laid onto us into something else, it's extremely likely to change the way I deal with the world and change the way the world deals with me. But it is a kind of pretty hairy experience in itself. I guess it's another fall off a ledge and further down the rabbit hole to start seeing more widely how easily confused I have been by reading things that for no good reason at all I believe to be reliable. As I say, I think Velikovsky is in a bit of a different school, because he is managing to actually make physical predictions that do turn out to be more or less accurate, and I think that is the mark of what I personally would regard as good science, is if you're looking at what you've got and coming up with some ideas as to how other things might work that you haven't previously experienced and they're right, then I think that's absolutely cracking. We can't really say that about so many things. also far away and in the other hemisphere, in Siberia, the Vogels carried down through the centuries and millennia this memory. God sent a sea of fire upon the earth. The cause of the fire they call the fire water. In the East Indies, the Aboriginal tribes relate that in the remote past, a water of fire rained from the sky, and with very few exceptions, all men died. The Midrashim, which are another sacred text, state that naphtha, together with hot stones, poured upon Egypt, and that the population of Egypt was pursued with strange rains and hails and showers inexorable and utterly consumed with fire. But what was more marvellous of all, in the water which quencheth all things, the fire wrought yet more mightily. And that, of course, we know to be the nature of burning petroleum. And it makes sense of the kind of the sort of wildfires that the Israelites come across when they're doing their 40 years of wandering in the desert. If I remember rightly, and I think Velikovsky mentions it, that they kept coming across these fires out in the desert, that things would just burst into flames. And there were a couple of bits. There was a bit to do with Moses and the brother of Moses, Aaron, who was a priest to Yahweh or something, and there's a point at which he brings strange fire to the Lord and is consumed, basically. There's also bits where whole loads of people disappear in fire out on the periphery of the camp and all of that. So it was a pretty pervasive thing for quite a long time. This burning liquid, and to this day, of course, the naphtha lies close to the surface over in the Middle East. Velikovsky actually reckons that the rain of firewater contributed to the Earth's supply of petroleum, that rock oil in the ground appears to be, partly at least, star oil brought down at the close of the world ages. Notably the age that came to its end in the middle of the second millennium before the present era. And of course, the making of coal is one of those things that we have hypotheses about. And this is all connected with Velikovsky's prediction that there'd be high levels of hydrocarbons found on Venus, which indeed there were, because he reckons that's where all of this fire came from. And in the centuries that followed, I think perhaps unsurprisingly, petroleum was actually worshipped. It was burned in holy places, which is presumably what it was that happened to Aaron. It was also used for domestic purposes. But then somehow many ages passed when it was out of use, and it would appear that only in the middle of the last century did we begin to exploit this oil. And now, you know, the roads are crowded with vehicles propelled by oil, but there was a long time when we didn't use it. And who knows, maybe it came from the stars. And after the rain of rocks and the running of all the animals and the rusty waters and stuff, I think also that was probably the time at which That was probably the time at which the Israelites started encountering the rivers of milk and honey, as were, it has to be said, encountered by many people around the world at about this time. They also found that after the Red Rivers, they got rivers of milk and honey, and Velikovsky's theory on that is that your hydrocarbons, which can burn, are broadly speaking, so he says, I wouldn't know, pretty much the same thing as carbohydrates, and that you might as well get one as the other out of the basic raw material. And so it would appear that the manna, which is talked about in the Old Testament, really did sort of, condense somehow out of the air, and it would appear that it was only there in the early morning. I think it disappeared after that or something, but by and large, the stuff which kept them alive isn't just some kind of weird rumour or something that the Lord threw to the land. Well, I suppose the Lord did, if you recognise that the Lord is Venus. But that it was there, it did sustain them, and it was made out, according to Velikovsky, of the stuff that came from a comet's tail. So even somehow in all of the mayhem and chaos that was going on and the high death rates and all of that, somehow the people that were out there who survived it were given kind of miracle food as a result of the thing that was causing all the damage, which is just, I was quite surprised by that. Well, I had heard that the manor really did exist, but it's really strange to think that you're actually eating a comet's tail. So the Earth entered deeper into the tail of the onrushing comet, because it's big, this. You know, we put it down, put people's, the ancient fear of comets down to them not really understanding what's going on. But just imagine a comet the size of Venus, like a planet-sized comet, really close. In fact, so close that the planet is apparently actually travelling through its tail. And as it enters deeper into the tail of the onrushing comet, so it's a head-to-head, this approach, if one is to believe the sources, was followed by a disturbance in the rotation of the Earth. Now, here's another major change. There's been, as regular listeners I've no doubt will know, one of my main interests from a long time ago has been calendars, especially the Mayan calendar, and how they work, how we've dated things. And actually, the closer you look at that, the more weird it becomes. You find that Romulus, the founder of Rome, had what looks to us to be a completely insane calendar that was 10 months long and quite a few days short of the year. There were calendars all around the world for quite a long time that ran on 360 days. And then at some point there was a bit of a hiatus and we ended up with what we've got now, which is 365 and a quarter and a bit, or whatever it is. And it turns out that this is probably the reason that as the planetary bodies' fields of influence, electrical influence, get close to each other, there can be some jarring and some slowing down of the one by the other. And as a result, you know, maybe the axis tilts in a different direction. All sorts of things, various things can happen, but it certainly seems to have meant that the day length changed each time this kind of influence was felt. So suddenly we're, once again, if you actually look at the established histories of the calendar, a bit like geological and biological evolution, they quite strongly and most definitely imply that the movement has been from an imperfect thing through to a thing which is now so perfect we measure it in the vibrations of an invisible cesium atom or something. But this is, once again, made quite clearly here. Not to be the case. It explains to me why the massive henge up in Thornborough, is it Thornborough? Might be not quite the right name. It's the biggest henge, I think, that they've found. But some of the circles in it are 360 and some of them are 366. And at some point, apparently, we did have a 366-day year as well. So, followed by a disturbance in the rotation of the Earth, which would have a really huge effect in terms of time and everything, and you'd have to do all of your observations again. But also, it results in terrific hurricanes, which was, of course, another of the plagues, sweeping the Earth because of the change or reversal of the kind of direction of rotation, and because of the sweeping gases, dust and cinders of the comet. Apparently this exceedingly strong wind endured for 7 days. All the time the land was shrouded in darkness. On the 4th, 5th and 6th days, the darkness was so dense that they, the people of Egypt, could not stir from their place. The darkness was such that their eyes were blinded by it and their breath choked. It was not of ordinary earthly kind. The rabbinical tradition, which is, of course, the priestly tradition, it's the one that gets shown to your initiates, not just to the people who are kind of basically attending prayer. And it really rather contradicts the spirit of our more usual scriptural narrative, and it states that during the plague of darkness, the vast majorities of the Israelites perished, and that only a small fraction of the original Israelite population of Egypt was spared to actually leave Egypt. It's reckoned in the rabbinical tradition that 49 out of every 50 Israelites are said to have perished in that particular plague. And that is really, it says, I haven't got the quote here, but it does actually say pretty much the other thing, I think, in the Bible. It basically says that everybody left. Because, of course, the darkness was taken as an excuse for them to nick the silver, if I remember rightly, and make it out of the place. I think I'm right in remembering that. But alas, it wasn't quite that easy by the sound of it. And if the darkness in Egypt was caused by the Earth's stasis, or by a tilting of its axis, and if it was aggravated by kind of dust from the comet, then the entire globe would presumably have suffered from the effect of these two concurring phenomena. And in either the eastern or the western parts of the world, there must have been a very extended gloomy day. And nations and tribes in many places of the globe, to the south and to the north and to the west of Egypt, have old traditions about a cosmic catastrophe during which the sun did not shine. But in some parts of the world, the traditions maintain that the sun did not set for a period of time equal to a few days, which is exactly what one would expect on the other side of the world. If it was a maintained darkness on one side, you will see maintained light on the other. The Finns tell of a time when hailstones of iron fell from the sky. See, they even knew what they were made of. And the sun and the moon disappeared and did not appear again in their standard places. In the manuscripts of traditions of the Indians of the New World, it's related that the sun did not appear for 5 days. A cosmic collision of stars preceded the cataclysm. People and animals tried to escape to mountain caves. And of course, all of this must be happening pretty much immediately overhead. These planets are not distant specks out in space, not recognisable to hardly anybody as they are nowadays. In order to have this sort of effect, they were well close. And here's another book I've got that is, I have no doubt, going to be transformed, is the Epic of Gilgamesh, another one I know that I've seen mentioned in the chat box on TNS before now. But that too, it would appear, all of these stories are about the stars and the planets. And in the Epic of Gilgamesh, it refers to these events. From out of the horizon rose a dark cloud, and it rushed against the earth. The land was shriveled by the heat of the flames. Desolation stretched to heaven. All that was bright was turned into darkness. Nor could a brother distinguish his brothers. 6 days. The hurricane, deluge and tempest continued sweeping the land, and all humans back to clay were returned. If the earth didn't stop rotating but slowed down or was tilted, there must have been a longitude where a prolonged day was followed by a prolonged night, if you were exactly on the cusp of all of this. And it just so happens that Iran is so situated that if one's to believe their tradition, the sun was absent for a threefold day, and then it shone for a threefold day. Farther to the east, there must have been a protracted day corresponding to the protracted night in the west. And according to Barman Yast, at the end of a world age in eastern Iran or in India, the sun remained 10 days visible in the sky. In China, during the reign of the suspiciously named Emperor Yahu, looks kind of like Yahweh, a catastrophe brought a world age to a close. For 10 days, the sun did not set. The events of the time of the Emperor Yahu deserve closer examination. So, he must have been well pleased, Al Velikovsky, with that particular set of research, because having made a set of predictions from what he'd read about the Exodus, about what he was going to find elsewhere, he was not disappointed in any of his expectations and found documents around the world that basically backed him up. I think that there's another cheerful point to be made on that one, is that it means that at least so far the destruction of documents has not been thorough enough to prevent this sort of discovery. I would wonder, though, how much luck you would have. This was done in 1950. I'd wonder how much luck you'd have if you were to try to access all of the documents and the bewildering array of sources that he's managed to get together for this, if you were to try to get them together in this internet age. And the 10th plague, Pharaoh, oh, here we go. The earth, forced out of its regular motion, reacted to the close approach of the body of the comet, and a major shock convulsed the lithosphere. And the area of the earthquake was the entire globe. So our Egyptian eyewitness, Ippowa, survived the earthquake, and he says the towns are destroyed. Upper Egypt has become a waste. All is ruin. The residence is overturned in a minute. And only an earthquake could overturn the residents in a minute, really. The Egyptian word for to overturn is used in the sense of to overthrow a wall. This was the tenth plague, and Pharaoh rose up in the night, he and all his servants and all the Egyptians, and there was a great cry in Egypt, for there was not a house where there was not one dead. Houses fell smitten by one violent blow. The angel of the Lord passed over the houses of the children of Israel in Egypt when he smote the Egyptians and delivered our houses. And it's reckoned, this one's probably right, that the Israelis did survive this one, where it really, the Egyptians didn't, and it was because of where they were living. We've seen this happen in earthquake zones before. It's reckoned that the reason why the Israelites were more fortunate in this plague than the Egyptians is probably because of the kind of material that they were, their dwellings were made of. Because they were occupying a sort of boggy district, as a lot of our ancestors tended to, and were working on clay, the captives must have lived in huts made of clay and reeds, which are more resilient than brick or stone, and I would say less likely to kill you when they fall on you as well. The Lord will pass over the door and will not suffer the destroyer to come and smite your houses. Well, sounds pretty intentional, doesn't it? But I guess it's a kind of mixture of luck and poverty and slave status that did that to them. So hey guys, maybe slave status ain't entirely bad. Just joking. An example of just this kind of selective action of a natural agent upon various kinds of construction is also found in the Mexican annals. During a catastrophe accompanied by a hurricane and earthquake, only the people who lived in small log cabins remained uninjured. The larger buildings were swept away. They found that those who lived in small houses had escaped, as well as the newly married couples whose custom it was to live for a few years in cabins in front of those of their fathers-in-law. I think it was in Ages of Chaos that Velikovsky showed that the firstborn, I don't know how you say that, B-K-H-O-R is the original word that's used, in the text, of the plague is a corruption of chosen, B-C-H-O-R. So he's saying that the curse of the firstborn was actually the curse of the chosen, and he did say that all the flower of Egypt succumbed in this catastrophe. The children of princes are dashed against the walls, the children of princes are cast out in the street. The prison is ruined, wrote our eyewitness, or Velikovsky's eyewitness. And to confirm his interpretation of the 10th plague as an earthquake, which should be obvious from the expression to smite the houses, he finds a corroborating passage of Artapanus in which he describes the last night before the Exodus, and which is quoted by the historian, for what that use that word is, Eusebius. There was hail and earthquake by night, so that those who fled from the earthquake were killed by the hail, and those who sought shelter from the hail were destroyed by the earthquake. And at that time, all the houses fell in, and most of the temples. And we knew, we know, that if there's one thing those guys could do, it's build a good solid temple. They were well good at that. It does mean that certain of the structures we've got standing on Earth right now do appear to have survived these catastrophes. Must have been properly built. So the head of the celestial body, which was called Typhon in myth, approached very close, breaking through the darkness of our atmosphere, and according to the Midrashim, the last night in Egypt was as bright as the noon on the day of the summer solstice. We got ourselves a spare sun. The lightnings lightened the world. Lightnings lightened the world. The earth trembled and shook. Thou ledst thy people like a flock by the hand of Moses and Aaron. And for that, that leading, they were taking on the sign that they were brought out of Egypt by a portent which looked like a stretched arm, by a stretched out arm, and by great terrors, or with a mighty hand, and with an outstretched arm, and with great terribleness, and with sighs, and with wonders. And we will find, when we look at comets, that they can take up all sorts of shapes. It seems that there's a particular myth about that time when the sun stopped in the sky. What it actually did was it stopped and went backwards about 10 degrees and then hung around there for a while and then eventually was unleashed to to, I think, maybe travel in the other direction, because east and west, the directions of the rising and the setting of the sun have demonstrably changed in the past as well. I've never seen any hint of that before. But one of the myths that that is common around the world is that it was tethered. The sun was tethered for a while, and that eventually a mouse came and nibbled at the tether and freed the sun. And this is an idea which is actually pretty common around the world, apparently. So, as we say, common experience, common expression, very common expression implies common experience. So it's thought by some that there was probably a mouse-shaped comet that came and did more or less exactly that. And the best way of describing it was to describe what it looked like if you had absolutely no bloody idea what it actually was. Interestingly, it was at midnight, all the houses of Egypt were smitten. There was not a house where there was not one dead. And this happened on the night of the 14th of the month of Aviv. This is the night of Passover. It appears that the Israelites originally celebrated Passover on the eve of the 14th of Aviv. That month is called the first month in Exodus, though was the name of the first month of the Egyptians. What for the Israelites became a feast became a day of sadness and fasting for the Egyptians. The 13th day of the month is a very bad day. Thout, that's it. The 13th day of the month, Thout, is a very bad day. Thou shalt not do anything on this day. It is the day of the combat which Horus waged with Seth. So, I thought that was quite interesting as well. That the Egyptians really didn't like the number 13, which is something we've very much taken on board on the West. I was pretty stunned when I found that some hotels don't have 13th floors or room 13s or anything like that, because it's regarded as that unlucky. Where it is a local challenge, that one, because I think the Maya have got a lot more time for the number 13 than they have for the number 10. For them, number 10 is like a number of manifestation. It's when things come to pass, and you're better off in a, you know, calm state waiting for it. So they were quite keen on 13, not keen on 10. We're not keen on 13. I did see recently a fairly decent argument putting forward the fact that what we see on the crown of the throne of England is actually a Hebrew pharaoh rather than a queen. And let's just say I don't find it impossible to believe that that's the case. They certainly had a couple of dozen pieces of circumstantial evidence to back up that claim. But who knows? Perhaps she brought with her the fear of 13 embedded in our society and the societies around us. And the Hebrews counted and still count the beginning of the day from sunset. The Egyptian reckoned from sunrise. As the catastrophe took place at midnight, for the Israelites it was the 14th day of the first month. For the Egyptians, it was the 13th day. You can tell he spent a bit of time looking at this stuff, can't you? The swift shifting of the atmosphere under the impact of the gaseous parts of the comet, the drift of air attracted by the body of the comet, and the rush of the atmosphere resulting from inertia when the Earth stopped rotating or shifting its poles, all contributed to produce hurricanes of enormous velocity and force and of worldwide dimensions. Some of the Mayan documents describe this particularly well. This seems to have been very well remembered there. They probably have quite a lot of hurricanes, has to be said, so probably they've got all the words they need to describe them. But they tell of a cosmic catastrophe during which the ocean fell on the continent and a terrible hurricane swept the earth. The hurricane broke up and carried away all towns and all forests. Exploding volcanoes, tides sweeping over mountains, and impetuous winds threatened to annihilate humankind, and actually did annihilate many species of animals. The face of the earth changed. Mountains collapsed, other mountains grew and rose over the onrushing cataract of water. Driven from oceanic spaces, numberless rivers lost their beds, and a wild tornado moved through the debris descending from the sky. The end of the world age was caused by Hurricane, the physical agent that brought darkness and swept away houses and trees and even rocks and mounds of earth. And from this name is derived the very word hurricane. Hurricane destroyed the major part of the human race. In the darkness swept by wind, resinous stuff fell from the sky, and participated with fire and water in the destruction of the world. For 5 days, save for the burning naphtha and burning volcanoes, the world was dark, since the sun did not appear. There was also a bit of trouble with the tides. The ocean tides are produced by the actions of the sun and to a larger extent by that of the moon. A larger body than the moon or one nearer to the earth would act with greater effect. A comet with a head as large as the earth passing sufficiently close would raise the waters of the oceans miles high. The slowing down or stasis of the earth in its rotation would cause a tidal recession of water toward the poles. But the celestial body nearby would disturb this poleward recession, drawing the water toward itself. The fact that accumulations of stones were transferred from the equator toward higher latitudes is one of the enigmatic problems associated with the Ice Age theory, but it can be explained by this poleward recession of waters at the moment. The velocity of rotation was reduced, or the poles were shifted, or whatever. In the northern hemisphere in India, the moraines were carried from the equator not only toward higher latitudes, but they were taken toward the Himalaya Mountains, and in the southern hemisphere, from the equatorial regions of Africa toward the higher latitudes, across prairies and deserts and forests of the Black Continent. So, huge tides moving about as well. And at the same time, the seas were heaped up in immense tides. There was a pageant going on in the sky, which presented itself to the horrified lookers on Earth as a gigantic battle. And because this battle was seen from almost all parts of the world, and because it impressed itself very strongly upon the imagination of the peoples, it can be reconstructed in some detail. And some of those records are exactly what the Thunderbolts people are looking at. And there follows a slightly, just a kind of page passage, which describes the electrical aspects of what was going on, as Velikovsky understands it. So I'm going to have a bit of a music break, get myself a cup of tea, and have a look in the chat box to see what's going on in there. When the Earth passed through the gases, dust, and meteorites of the tail of the comet, disturbed in rotation, it proceeded on a distorted orbit. Emerging from the darkness, the eastern hemisphere faced the head of the comet. This head, only shortly before, had passed close to the sun and was in a state of candescence. The night the great earthquake shook the globe was, according to rabbinical literature, the priestly literature, as bright as the day of the summer solstice. Because of the proximity of the Earth, the comet left its own orbit and for a while followed the orbit of the Earth. The great ball of the comet retreated and then again approached the Earth, shrouded in a dark column of gases which looked like a pillar of smoke during the day and a fire at night. And the Earth once more passed through the atmosphere of the comet, this time at its neck. This stage was accompanied by violent and incessant electrical discharges between the atmosphere of the tail and the terrestrial atmosphere. There was an interval of about 6 days between these two close approaches. Emerging from the gases of the comet, the Earth seems to have changed the direction of its rotation, and the pillar of smoke moved to the opposite horizon. The column looked like a gigantic moving serpent. When the tidal waves rose to their highest point and the seas were torn apart, a tremendous spark flew between the Earth and the globe of the comet, which instantly pushed down the miles-high billows. Meanwhile, the tail of the comet and its head, having become entangled with each other by their close contact with the Earth, themselves exchanged violent discharges of electricity. It looked like a battle between the brilliant globe and the dark column of smoke. In the exchange of electrical potentials, the tail and the head were attracted one to the other and repelled one from the other. From the serpent-like tail, extensions grew and it lost the form of a column. It looked now like a furious animal with legs and with many heads. The discharges tore the column to pieces, a process that was accompanied by a rain of meteorites upon the Earth. It appeared as though the monster were defeated by the brilliant globe and buried in the sea, or wherever the meteorites fell, the gases of the tail subsequently enveloped the Earth. The globe of the comet, which lost a large portion of its atmosphere, as well as much of its electrical potential, withdrew from the Earth, but did not break away from its attraction. Apparently, after a 6-week interval, the distance between the Earth and the globe of the comet again diminished. This new approach of the globe could not be readily observed because the Earth was still shrouded in the clouds of dust left by its comet's former approach, as well as by dust ejected by volcanoes. After renewed discharges, the comet and the Earth parted. This behaviour of the comet is of great importance in problems of celestial mechanics, that a comet encountering a planet can become entangled and drawn away from its own path, forced into a new course and finally liberated from the influence of the planet, is proved by the case of Lexell's comet, which in 1767 was captured by Jupiter and its moons. Not until 1779 did it free itself from this entanglement. A phenomenon that has not been observed in modern times is an electrical discharge between a planet and a comet, and also between the head of a comet and its trailing part. The events in the sky that were viewed by the peoples of the world as a fight between an evil monster in the form of a serpent and the light god, who engaged the monster in battle and thus saved the world. The tale of the comet leaping back and forth under the discharges of the flaming globe was regarded as a separate body, inimical to the globe of the comet. And there, I think, is one of the most important passages for me out of the book, was that particular one, because just as you read in the text, it's calling to mind all kinds of archetypes and images that have been used for all sorts of ends and purposes in one kind of text than another, and here you can see them from a completely different point of view. I have in fact read that bit several times since then, and each time it's a bit like new sections of it leap to the fore. So all of that stuff appears to be it's certainly an interesting and coherent and extended claim on the part of Velikovsky. He's anticipated a lot, not only like people who do make successful predictions. He's not only anticipated what he wants on one basis, he's then subsequently gone. He's, if you like, anticipated the challenges that are likely to arise and met the challenges to try and keep his arrow true, as it were. And yet, as far as our history is concerned, it is like none of it ever happened. It is like it was just hail and, you know, a few people having a bit of local difficulty, albeit a little bit of local difficulty kind of all around the place. And worse still, I mean, I think this is the real killer. There is no evidence of any of this stuff in our sciences. As we say, your basic astronomical theory remains that inertia and gravity are the two driving forces of the cosmos, and that the cosmos is electrically neutral, that there are no electrical interchanges between planets, and certainly none of the kind of significance that we see reasonably well described in those biblical passages. And I'm with Mr. Talbot on that one. How is it possible that such overwhelming evidence, when it's put together by a coherent mind, can have appeared to be ludicrous and unbelievable? How can that have happened? Well, a little passage. I'm going to play a tune or maybe two, and then I'll be back with a little bit of explanation as to how it looks like that happens, because the manipulation of text and words has been something that's been with us for a long time. So that will be bit of a music break, and I'll come back with a little bit of commentary which explains why it is that we've been convinced that the obvious is ludicrous. In the meantime, this is Roxy Music's 1998 remix of Let's Stick Together. Let's stick together, folks. A couple of things that came up in the chat box whilst I was wittering away there. Sven mentioned that the first mention of the sun was in respect of Sodom and Gomorrah, which I didn't know. I must admit that it was the first mention of the sun. It is exactly where we're going, though. We're going to, by the end of the show, be talking about that first sun, which does indeed turn out to be Saturn. And it's reckoned by Velikovsky that, Saturn was ultimately the cause of the flood that is remembered worldwide, which was, if you liked, the about three acts ago in this great cosmic drama. The one we've been looking at tonight was two acts ago. The last act was thought by Velikovsky to have been several close intersections between the planet Mars and Earth. And in response to your query, Rich, about which book it is, the one I've been looking at tonight is just a little bit. It was really a deep cutting down of chapter two of Worlds in Collision by Emmanuel Velikovsky. And it is, as I keep saying, I'm sure I'm just going to bore people witless with it, but it has changed so many things for me. And if nothing else, it really does make a difference to be at last looking at some material which is almost, I think, by definition, containing information that is going to be a bit hard for people to undermine. Before Worlds in Collision comes Ages in Chaos. It was actually published afterwards. It was published after Worlds in Collision because he wanted to deal with the recent stuff first, but he deals with the much older cosmos and how it was that we got to the point where we got our first sun. But to go back to this idea of Sodom and Gomorrah, that was a very striking point Sven made, because it would appear that the interaction with Saturn involved the filaments interacting between the planet God and the Earth, hence more of the electrical discharge that we were reading about, to do with the comet, nominally Venus, known in legend as Typhon. And I'm sure at one point Velikovsky says that there's not just the gravitational pull of the planet and the moon and all the struggles that result in that pile up the tides, as it were, pile up the water, but there's also an element of charge involved, that somehow before these things actually rush to Earth or whatever it is that they're doing, there's a build-up of charge in the ionosphere, such as the one that we're seeing now, according to 3-Minute News. And it builds up and up and up and up until it just discharges itself, and it's like lightning, but not like lightning, if you know what I mean. And we can imagine pretty much that the result is a completely overwhelming thunderclap, and I would imagine the complete disappearance of places just exactly like Sodom and Gomorrah. We know that a similar thing happened, I think, as a result, might have been the comet one, might have been the Mars one, but a similar thing happened to a character called Sennacherib, who had his armies camped outside of probably Jerusalem. That's what they're mostly trying to get at. There's a regular enough kind of swing to the game by then for Isaiah. At least the Bible claims to have said broadly, I obviously paraphrase, you needn't worry about that. The sundial is going to click back 10 degrees tomorrow and, they're toast, basically. And behold, yea, verily, even the very next morning, they found just smoking clothes, according to Plato. The soles of the army were burnt and that their clothes were left, but that there was nothing left in them. And that was the end, a whole thunderclap, destroying armies and towns and stuff. So it's quite interesting to see that Saturn, or the sun, was first mentioned like that. In that particular connection, and Anna, not in Hampshire, no, I'm on the other side of the skirmish zone out in the wilds of Wales at the moment, and I'm told that I have roots in the industrial Midlands rather than the home counties, but what would I know, and what does it matter? Anyway, now we're going to have a brief intermission where we have a quick look at in Velikovsky's words, because he's not really fill us up all this, and it concerns once again the careful control of information, and in this particular form it makes it very easy to see that's what's going on, but And once again, I'm not sure how many of these texts are still extant, but Velikovsky says here, before I go on to the description of the day on which the prophecies of Isaiah were fulfilled, I should like to present the common view of generations of commentators. The books of the Mayas have come into the hands of only a few scholars, likewise the papyri of Egypt and the clay tablets of the Assyrians, but the book of Isaiah and other books of the scriptures have been read by millions during the centuries in hundreds of languages. Is the way in which Isaiah expressed himself obscure? It's a kind of collective psychological blind spot which prevents the understanding of the clearly revealed and scores of times repeated description of astronomical, geological and meteorological phenomena. The description was thought to be a peculiar kind of poetic metaphor, a flowery manner of expression. Even a modest attempt to review the various commentaries on Isaiah would burst the frame of a book much larger than this one. Therefore, it should satisfy the orthodox and the liberal reader alike if the opinions presented by two great authorities, and we're only going to look at one of them, in the world of thought are given here, and the thousands of commentators not quoted at all. No need to really, because they're pretty much represented by Moses Ben Maimon, called Rambam. Also, Maimonides, and he was said to have been around on this beautiful blue globe between the years 1135 and 1204, presumably corrected for the various corrections that need to be made. But he wrote a book called, right back then, he wrote a book called The Guide for the Perplexed. And he expressed the opinion that a belief in the creation is a fundamental principle of the Jewish religion, but we do not consider it a principle of our faith that the universe will again be reduced to nothing. It depends on his will, and 'tis therefore possible that he will preserve the universe forever. The belief in the destruction is not necessarily implied in the belief in the creation. We agree with Aristotle in one half of his theory. The opinion of Aristotle is that the universe, being permanent and indestructible, is also eternal and without beginning. With this theo-philosophic approach to the problem at large, Maimonides was averse to finding any word or sentence in the prophets or elsewhere in the Bible that would suggest a destruction of the world or even a change in its order. Each and every such expression he explained as a poetical substitute for an exposition of political ideas and acts. Maimonides says, "The stars have fallen, the heavens are overthrown, the sun is darkened, the earth is waste and trembles." And similar metaphors are frequently employed by Isaiah and less frequently by other prophets when they describe the ruin of a kingdom. In these phrases, the term mankind is used occasionally. This is also a metaphor, says Maimonides. Sometimes the prophets use the term mankind instead of the people of a certain place whose destruction they predict. E.g., Isaiah, speaking of the destruction of Israel, says, "And the Lord will remove man far away." Also, Zephaniah, "And I will cut off man from off the earth." He maintains that Isaiah and other seers of Israel, when examined by the realistic method of Aristotelianism, were persons inclined to exaggerated forms of speech, and instead of saying Babylon will fall or fell, they spoke in terms of some fantastic perturbation in the cosmos above and beneath. When Isaiah received the divine mission to prophesy the destruction of the Babylonian Empire, the death of Sennacherib and that of Nebuchadnezzar, who rose after the overthrow of Sennacherib, he commences in the following manner to describe their fall. "For the stars of heaven and the constellations thereof shall not give their light." Again, "Therefore I will shake the heavens, and the earth shall remove out of her place in the wrath of the Lord of hosts and in the day of his fierce anger." I do not think that any person is so foolish and blind and so much in favour of the literal sense of figurative and oratorical phrases as to assume that at the fall of the Babylonian kingdom a change took place in the nature of the stars of heaven, or in the light of the sun and the moon, or that the earth moved away from its centre. For all this is merely the description of a country that has been defeated. The inhabitants undoubtedly find all light dark and all sweet things bitter. The whole earth appears too narrow for them, and the heavens are changed in their eyes. He speaks in a similar manner when he describes the loss of the entire land of Israel when it came into the possession of Sennacherib. He says, "For the windows from on high are open, and the foundations of the earth do shake. The earth is utterly broken down. The earth is clean dissolved. The earth is moved exceedingly. The earth shall reel to and fro like a drunkard." The subjugation of Judea by Assyria was joyless, but what was so bad from Isaiah's point of view in the destruction of Babylon that the stars should not give their light? A reading of the literature indicates that no exegete has ever been so foolish and blind as to read sky for sky, stars for stars, brimstone for brimstone, fire for fire, blast for blast. Referring to the quoted verses, Isaiah 34:4-5, "My Monades writes, will any person who has eyes to see find in these verses any expression that is obscure or that might lead him to think that they contain an account of what will befall the heavens?" The prophet means to say that the individuals who are like stars as regards their permanent high and undisturbed position will quickly come down. Maimonides quotes Ezekiel, Joel, Amos, Micah, Haggai, Habakkuk and Psalms, and in verses similar to those already cited from Isaiah, he finds incidentally a description of a multitude of locusts, or a speech appropriate for the destruction of Samaria, or the destruction of Medes and Persians, spoken in metaphors which are intelligible to those who understand the context. In a settled world, nothing alters the given order. In a settled world, nothing alters the given order. To sustain this doctrine, the prophecies were translated into metaphors, for in the opinion of Maimonides, if the world does not change its regimented harmony, true prophets would not declare that it does. Our opinion, in support of which we have quoted these passages, writes Maimonides, is clearly established, namely, that no prophet or sage has ever announced the destruction of the universe, or a change of its present condition, or a permanent change of any of its properties. The standpoint of Maimonides, as far as a change of conditions in the universe is concerned, is a deduction, not from the text he interprets, but from a philosophical a priori approach. Prophets might err in their prophecies, but it could hardly be that in saying stars they meant persons. The reading of subsequent chapters in Isaiah and parallel chapters in Kings and Chronicles, in which Isaiah's prophecies are revisited, as well as the Talmudic and Midrashic fragments concerning the time of Sennacherib's invasion, makes it apparent that this time the prophets did not err, and that a change in harmonious conditions did occur in the lifetime of these very prophets, in the days of Hezekiah. Maimonides asserts that Joel's prophecies referring to Sennacherib, but he is puzzled. You may perhaps object, how can the day of the fall of Sennacherib, according to our explanation, be called the great and terrible day of the Lord? In the following pages, it will be shown that on the very day which preceded the night when Sennacherib's army was destroyed, the order of nature was upset. The speeches of the seers must be interpreted not apart from, but in the light of, the description of these changes as they are preserved in the scriptures and in the Talmud. There was keener insight during the times prior to Maimonides, and to these more ancient interpreters he referred when he wrote, "The universe, ever since, continues its regular course. This is my opinion. This should be our belief. Our sages, however, said very strange things as regards miracles. They are found in Bereshith Rabbah and in Midrash Koheleth, namely, that the miracles are to some extent also natural." So there you have it. That was something. There's a lot of bits I particularly enjoyed in Worlds in Collision. you won't be hearing any more of it from me, I don't think. So, like I say, I do recommend you go and get a look at it. But how about that? Putting it all down to a flowery metaphor and all of that, and suggesting that basically when they were talking about one thing, what they were secretly meaning was something else. And funnily enough, I was talking about this with a friend of mine who professes to the Rastafarian faith, who was telling me that that's what they've been telling them for as long as they can remember. Fire is fire, brimstone is brimstone, and smiting is smiting. There's no point trying to get out from under it. So before moving on to electric universe theory, where we see what the modern physicists are making of Velikovsky's material and making of the cosmos that they find themselves in, itself a very recent discovery for me. It's been on the periphery for a little bit, but only in the last couple of weeks have I had a chance to look at some of the most astonishing material that's out there. And as I say, that is a subject which is growing almost too fast to keep up. But in the meantime, things appearing to be the way they are, one way and the other, I'm going to play Hell Ain't No Bad Place to Be from If You Want Blood, You Got It. You're listening to Dr. Rock's radio show on tnsradio.com, scottishsovereignsontheland.ning.com, and scotlandisfree.ning.com. And we're talking non-uniformitarian solar system this evening. And now we're going to move on to the modern and exciting stuff, and at some point during this particular section of the show, hopefully you will feel like accessing the TNS at the slideshow that's at tnsradio.com, which has got a few illustrations to cover the more critical bits. So I shall try to describe briefly the pictures for anybody who can't actually see them. In his time in the 50s, Velikovsky was pretty much a solo voice, and as we've heard, orthodoxy did everything it could to ignore his ideas, convinced as it was, despite the predictive successes yielded by his hypotheses, that his approach was irrational and hence somehow invalid. But now there are many researchers, specialists in comparative mythology, planetary scientists, plasma physicists, who are seriously investigating Velikovsky's primary thesis, that the solar system might have been unstable at some point, alive with electrical activity, and that in the fairly recent past. All earlier civilizations were obsessed with the past, all looked back to an era of extraordinary events, to an age of gods and wonders, all insisted that powerful gods ruled for a time and then went away. As I said, that was a quote from one of the Thunderbolts Project's videos, which are available up on YouTube. This one is called Symbols of an Alien Sky, and like Velikovsky, it is I reckon required viewing for anybody who's even vaguely interested on what's been going on in our past, because it carries on where Velikovsky left off, but it has all of the marvels and techniques of modern presentation, modern plasma physics labs, and so much other stuff. So the Egyptians look back to an age when the singular god Atum ruled in the skies of Earth. For the Mesopotamians, this principal character was called An. To the Greeks, he was known as Kronos, Brahma of the Indus Valley civilization, Shangdi to the Chinese, Ometeotl to the Aztecs, and Itzamna to the Maya before them. One singular god, with many names, that ruled over a golden age on Earth, and then went away. So central were these and later manifestations of the rulers of the sky, that to remove the gods from the literature of these early peoples is to remove entirely the cultural content of their civilizations. All the stories, characters, and adventures narrated by mythology concentrate on the active powers among the stars who are the planets. That's a quote that they've used from Hamlet's Mill by Santayana and Drechend, which was published in November 1969, and is another Voice in the Wilderness. Another very well-read book, and again, another highly recommended text from the Doctor's Surgery, that one. That is, again, full of stuff which is unusual, and very much along the lines of the Velikovsky. What is normal in nature and society rarely excites the myth-making imagination, which is more likely to be kindled by the abnormal, some startling catastrophe. A quote from Lewis Farnell, a professor of Greek religion And that made me think once again of the sublimated behaviours, and it made me think of how the soap operas run. What is normal in nature and society rarely excites the myth-making imagination, which is perhaps why we have to see all the time constant crisis and drama and action on the televisions in front of us. The Thunderbolts people point out that the widespread presence of dragons in myth and story is enigmatic because there is no biological counterpart on which they might have been based, and yet they come to us from prehistory, are remembered on every habitable continent, and have persisted across the millennia and to modern times. How can we account for the archetype, long flowing hair, fiery breath, beard, twin whiskers, wings and feathers, and a global association with twins, that's one that always mystified me, and with lightning? It is worth remembering, perhaps, that both Velikovsky and Joseph Campbell concluded that, as I've said, a common expression so widely shared is most likely an indication of a common experience at some point in the past. How could the dragon type have arisen without provocation? And should we not wonder, ask the Thunderbolts people, if uniquely modern prejudices are the primary reason behind why the mystery remains unsolved? Past cultures worldwide often shared in a single cosmic vision, and we must not let our own present fragmented fields of knowledge hinder our attempt to recapture that vision. That's Bruce Mass, an environmental archaeologist at the University of Hawaii. Archetypes, the word means broadly, refers to a universally understood symbol or pattern of behaviour. It's a prototype upon which all others are copied, patterned, or emulated. So it is the first one, if you like, the original source of a general idea. Archetypes are perhaps surprisingly a major key to this mystery. That again came as a bit of a surprise to me. To Jung, who I think probably coined the term, these archetypes were symbols which he described as buried deep within the subconscious, lying beyond rational or scientific explanation. Archetypes lie beyond rational or scientific explanation. So they are in no way verifiable. We can't really get a handle on them. But one of the characteristics of the new science is that it tends to deal in the unverifiable, i.e. the science that's being given to us by the Brotherhood of Illuminism. Its job is to discover nothing. And Jung was certainly doing that here, whether he was part of the cabal or not. But one of the things the Thunderbolts guys are trying to do is they are moving the archetypes into the realm of rational and scientific explanation, which I'm sure is going to be as popular amongst orthodoxy as poor old Velikovsky was. To those who study mythology or mythohistory, as it might be more accurately called, the archetypes are points of agreement between far-flung cultures. This agreement rises above the carnival of contradiction and confusion. What a lovely phrase. And there are hundreds of these archetypes or cross-cultural points of reference and agreement. Visions in an Alien Sky emphasizes particularly, because they're on its direct, its critical path as it were, they emphasize the Dragon Slayer, the Pillar of the Gods or Cosmic Mountain, the Angry Goddess, which is the terrible aspect of the Benign Mother, the Ouroboros or Inclusing Serpent, and the Ladder to Heaven and the Dying God. At the dawn of history, all of the archetypes were already present, and new archetypes have not been born of modern experience, which is to say that we haven't had the experiences yet that were enjoyed, I suppose, whatever, by our ancestors. So if you go and have a quick look at the slide viewer behind the TNS chat box, and I shall, this is likely to be whilst I start trying to juggle two tools at once, you might have to put up with a little bit of muttering. If you move it on, it's entitled Rock Art, Plasma and a Young Solar System. It actually should say Younger Solar System, because we are dealing with fairly recent times. If you go on to the first picture, you will see, hopefully, if all goes according to plan, you will be able to see a picture of the Lascaux cave paintings. They're currently believed to be about 17,000 years old, and they're executed by what we would today call realists, when you look at the picture we've got, you can see clouds in the sky, you can see several different sorts of animal there. We can see a horse, and there's oxen in there. There's several different kinds of critter. It's actually easier to tell the difference. It's easier to spot the meat and what it is there than it is in most of the food that you get nowadays. The second slide, which says Lascaux detail, needs to be jumped because it's a detail of a small white space, but there is a second slide too, which gives a bit of a close-up of the centre of the previous one. Why the people who painted these murals disappeared remains a mystery to orthodoxy, although I suppose those who've been paying attention have probably got some idea of what might have happened to them. Perhaps even more mysterious is where they came from in the first place, because the Lascaux cave paintings are something, as far as I know, of a unique and sudden arising. And then very quickly, for mysterious reasons, our ancient ancestors moved on to painting the kind of things that we see in slides 3 to 5. Absurd creatures and ghostly figures, which, like the dragon, have never been seen before in our world. So, slide 3. Okay, it's taken a while for it to get my pictures. Shows a bit of a scene from the American Southwest, when our ancestors, who had heretofore been pretty keen on painting pictures of the things they saw in everyday life, suddenly decided, as far as orthodoxy is concerned, to go entirely imaginative. And what we have here is a rock painting of several broadly human-like figures. These ones are kind of shaped like barrels with little heads on top of them. There's one or two differently shaped creatures amongst them. Look a bit like clubs or cacti with points on the top of them. Slide 4 shows a similar scene from Australia, somewhere else entirely. It also shows creatures with, these ones have got what look like feather headdresses on, and they're surrounded by tiny little stick creatures of various shapes and sizes. It is a very trippy, trippy looking scene indeed, that particular Australian one. And the next absurd creatures one, slide 5. Shows more typical things, including one of my favourites, the picture of a man with a duck on his head, which turns out to be found in some quantities all over the world. There are also several other enigmatic patterns, some of which look like serpents, some of which look like stick creatures, like a stick man with a pair of legs, pair of arms, and some concentric circles where his head should be. There's a picture of a thing that looks a bit like a penguin holding a wand. All of these strange pictures, I made no note of where these particular ones come from, but they're pretty typical of what we see around the place. I always did wonder where Terry Pratchett got his idea for the man with the duck on his head, and now I know. And one of the secrets as to what these things actually are is revealed in slide 6, one form that occurs in quantity all over the world, shows slight variations on a recognisable form. It's basically an apparently human figure with arms, legs, body, and significantly a pair of dots, one under each arm. The four that I've chosen to represent from the symbols of an alien sky come from Spain, Armenia, the United Arab Emirates, and Arizona. There are many, many more shown in the video, each variant on the basic form, but including the main elements that I just summarised. Anthony Perrat, spelt, I believe, with two R's and a T, P-E-R-R-A-T, of Los Alamos Laboratories, has shown that these stick forms recorded electrical events in the sky, and he matches each of the rock art forms precisely to configurations taken by high-energy electric discharge in the laboratory. I'll try and post some links to these materials when I have a bit of a music break. But there is now one that, like I say, we only received a link to a couple of days ago, which gives a lot more detail on this particular shape and on the shape cast by the plasma discharge that's shown when you move to slide 7. I'm just going to have a quick look in the chat box to make sure everybody's happy in that. It's quite difficult to do when you've got the slideshow going as well. Let's have a quick check to make sure that all's going cool. Yeah, indeed, Ray. Some of them have got balls as well. The balls and heads are significant too. I think that's the closest thing they could draw there, but yeah, they will have normally a little protrusion where the balls should be and a bigger one where the head should be. But from that comment, I can see that you're seeing everything happening, so we will just carry on regardless now. Variations in representations of the stickman and the dots are matched throughout by variations in the form taken by the electrical discharge in a plasma. And as I said, I think the it's called the field primer. Field primers, part one, I think is what it's called. Shows you exactly what these forms are. So that's something to look at afterwards. And the basic, so you should have slide 7 up in front of you now, or if you're keeping up or not gone too far, which shows a picture of the stickman on the bottom part. It tells you that it comes courtesy of Anthony Peratt. I've put Thunderbolts info and symbols of an alien sky on the bottoms of all the pictures so that people know where I got them from, and hopefully you'll be encouraged to go and seek more of this material because it's great, it's really great. You can see above the stickman figure that there's a kind of purple form, which is a representation of what happens when high energy electrical discharge occurs in a plasma, and basically there happens to be a magnetic field at the very top and a magnetic field at the very bottom. If you go on to slide 10, which is called configuration of a plasma discharge, it's actually configuration of an electrical discharge in plasma. I was in a bit of a hurry when I put them together, and you can see the basic elements of this. At the top we've got the pair of arms of the stickman reaching up and slightly out from the elbow, giving us the impression of a champagne glass slightly opening as it moves towards the top. And in there you've got a blob of energy, which looks like a head. You've then got what might be called the spine of the stickman, which is the axis that the discharge is travelling down. You then have round the middle, round the thorax of what would be the stickman, about round where our heart, it would include the heart and solar plexus if it were a human entity. And the two dots, it turns out, are a high energy torus, which radiates its own kind of radiation called synchrotron radiation. And then at the very bottom, made by the two legs, we have what's called a flattened bell, because the feet appear to be pointing slightly outwards. And this man's only got one ball, Ray, but hey, it's hanging on a big sack, look. This all varies out of a lot. Sometimes you get a little V-section of the legs and the protrusion is missing and all of that. But these are all replicatable in the laboratory, we're told, and as I say, you can go to the primer fields and see them actually making them. They've got a really fantastic bell jar thing where they're making all these different shapes. Oh, here it is. Yeah, the primer fields, part one, that's what it's called. I'll post a link shortly. These videos contain really exceptional data in which these primer fields videos contain really exceptional data. In which a character called David LaPointe backs up the claims of the people at the Thunderbolts and demonstrates that this plasma form is actually at the heart of the entire material structure in the cosmos, from subatomic particles to planets and galaxies, and he does a whole load of really brilliant things with magnetized and unmagnetized steel balls to demonstrate. It really is fun, really fun physics, and important too, I think. Interesting for me, these videos also show how ball bearings that roll into the magnetic fields represented by the top, by the flattened bell and the champagne glass in the picture we've been looking at. The ball bearings that roll into a magnetic field between those two things form first a triangle, then a square, then a pentagon. That's what they do. They just spring themselves naturally in there, and they're kind of attracted towards each other to a certain point and repelled from each other beyond that point. And then they just keep chucking ball bearings in there, and all the ball bearings keep staying apart and coming closer together in a kind of dance. It takes them a while. I noticed there was a reference to the flower of life in the chat box earlier on. the famous design where you put six equal sized circles on the circumference of a central circle, and then you carry on drawing more circles wherever circles already drawn meet others, and it leads to a very engaging six petaled interlacing flower design. It takes the ball bearings a little bit longer to get there because they need more balls to do it, but eventually that is exactly what they do. They sit there, slap bang in the centres. The ball bearings are sitting in the centres of where the circles would be in the flower of life design, and there they are, held in the primary field, as it were, that operates the entire cosmos. You can see on the primer fields videos superimposition of the fields they know are being generated within these plasmas, to be applied to all manner of things, especially galaxies. They're making sense of things which are currently, like most things actually, completely mysterious to NASA. After the picture of the plasma comes slide 11, which shows a whole load of basically stick figures that are quite apparently dozens of the kind of discharge patterns we've been talking about on a single rock in Saudi Arabia. And these images occur similarly in groups all over the world, so they're not only widespread, but where they do occur, there are often many of them. And again, until the laboratory work was undertaken and the similarities identified, these figures were a complete mystery to both archaeology and history, who are archaeologists and historians are quite often as on the ball as NASA. Recent work moves these images as carved effectively from mystery to history. Yet another fantastic transformation, really. And once again, it is the demystification of symbol. One of the ways, it's not just the words, it's the symbols in our mind that are so useful at controlling ideas, controlling the way we respond and the way we behave. And every time we move these symbols, every time we do that to them, every time we move something from mystery to history, then we are clarifying our worldview. And as Velikovsky suggests, written history covers only a small part of humanity's time on Earth, though it seems that humans have been here to experience global events that we've led to believe occurred before humankind really had any means of expressing these experiences in modes comprehensible to those of us that would come afterwards anyway. By gaining an understanding of rock art images such as these, we're effectively extending the comprehensible part of the story that's been recorded. We are extending history beyond the dawn of writing, which, given that we know what writing is, can't be a bad thing. Further to this, the collation of thousands of these rock art images have enabled Peratt to set up a supercomputer which identifies formations as seen from different positions on Earth. And the Thunderbolts people say the fit that he has documented cannot be accidental. Investigations by the Thunderbolts project, which preceded Peratt's by 3 decades or so, converge with this later work in extraordinary ways. So there is now, effectively, at last, a well-established new approach to our history, and the history of our solar system. One that considers high-energy electrical events in the ancient skies, and those who pursue this line of investigation must not be afraid to ask how the movements of planets may have contributed to an electrified cosmic environment of which science knew nothing only a few decades ago. And just look how long they've been chucking things up there, folks. Look how long they've been chucking things up there. Electronic things as well. Things that get broken when they encounter storms of positively charged particles, and yet they still seem, at least for public consumption, to be denying the fact that there's anything other than inertia and gravity involved. We see that when they actually approach with a project called Deep Impact, the comet Tempel 1. They're not looking for electrical stuff, they're looking entirely for water, and it's bonkers, it is. Really bonkers. William Napier, he's an astronomer from Armagh Observatory, is quoted by a caption in Symbols of an Alien Sky as saying, "Modern astronomical evidence does not support the common supposition that the night sky has been unchanging for 5,000 years. And that's just 5,000 years. The orthodox model is trying to maintain that the solar system has been uniformitarian or stable more or less since it cooled down some nominal 3.5 billion years ago. And the claim is that all the planet bumping and cosmic pinball occurred whilst everything was still hot and molten, roughly in the billion years between the solar system's supposed inception and its assumed cooling. In Ages in Chaos, Velikovsky claims that at some point in the distant past, Saturn, now just a distant speck in the darkened vault of night, ruled the skies over Earth day and night. Close to the Earth and vast, it is remembered as the exemplary sun, the sun of a golden age. And the Egyptian Atum, the Assyrian Shamash are both characterizations of Saturn. The Romans, whilst also giving us the name Saturn, they also referred to this entity as Sol, or Sun. The Greek equivalent, Kronos, was also known to them as Helios, which means sun. And Saturn was known to the Hebrews as El, so now we know who El was, presumably the Elohim. And there's an amazing amount of mysterious cultural baggage even today that in its beginnings stemmed from attention to Saturn, a planet, not a god, in the heavens. Also, of course, a little bit more of the sublimated fears and behaviour. Saturn was remembered as the devourer of his own children, which is where this two-show outing started, was effectively with the devouring of children. They might as well be. And if we look at slide 10, we should see a symbol, a picture of an Egyptian obelisk pointing at a specific part of the night sky, and it says on it, symbol of Atum. This is the point in the night sky around which the stars of the night sky appear to revolve. So it's a bit like where the pole star is for us now. I'll do a nice little animation on the symbols video, which shows just that happening later on behind this this stellar. Saturn at this point was the great light of heaven, motionless in the sky. So that stellar would have pointed at Saturn, and the night sky was revolving round behind Saturn, and the Earth was revolving round Saturn, which appeared to be static in the sky because of the way things were set up at that point. And so it is presumably that the Egyptian coffin texts say the great god lives fixed in the middle of the sky. The star, interestingly, the star watchers of ancient China, Greece and Persia were in agreement with the celestial cartography of the Egyptians. Saturn, it would appear, did really sit in the same point in the sky. Saturn was also known, and here we start coming into more of the archetypes, more of the programs that are running deep within our inner selves. Saturn was known as the father of kings, the father of the nation, the father of the race. The ancient Israelites allegedly at one time saw themselves as the children of Saturn. And likewise, the early Romans insisted that they were the true descendants of Saturn. No, you're not, we're the true descendants of Saturn. And that they arrived in Italy through the adventures of the mythical hero Aeneas. And in Virgil's story of Aeneas, again quoted in the video, in the Aeneid, Virgil says, "Deign to know the Latins, Saturn's race, a race freely self-controlled, as in the olden days, a race freely self-controlled, as in the olden days." Perhaps that's how it was before the thunderclaps of Saturn saw to us. Perhaps we did used to be what we would like to be again now. And I also found it quite interesting that it seems that the Roman Republic believed itself at birth to be freely self-controlled. Could it be that an influence arose, perhaps with the knowledge of ancient secrets carried forward from the remembered golden age, to undermine and invalidate this belief, an influence that eventually became the legislative bureaucracy that eventually overwhelmed the ancient freedom so celebrated? And so all of this is important to us. You know, we can see these influences, we can see the use of these archetypes, habits that are being kind of burnt in upon us. And as they say, in the face of evidence that cannot be denied, the reasonable course is to bring the catastrophic source of these memories into the light, not to bury it in scripture, and not then to keep burying it through the commentary with the likes of Spinoza and Maimonides. As well, the author and narrator of the Symbols video published a book in 1980, which was called The Saturn Myth, and it, interestingly, it is published by Doubleday, the publishers who chucked Velikovsky off for being irrational. In the book, Talbot began the reconstruction from the mytho-historical evidence. So he's looked at all of these myths that we've been talking about, of a spectacular formation formerly seen in the night sky, a gathering of planets looming immense above the ancient witnesses. And different cultures have used different symbols to represent what he calls eerily similar events, and Talbot uses these similarities to deduce the shape of his model. Effectively, he's working with the archetypes mentioned earlier, common patterns that are not only hidden deep within the human subconscious, but are also extant across time and culture. A set of symbols collectively known as cosmic wheels is central to Talbot's model. Like the Stickman discharge figures, cosmic wheels have been carved onto stone in various forms all over the world. And if we go on to slide 12, you should see a picture of three such cosmic wheels. Sorry, slide 13 is David Talbot's Saturn Myth book. And slide 14 is the one you're after, which is entitled Three Cosmic Wheels, and it shows them from various unlabeled places. Sometimes these wheels are singular, but more often they occur in groups. Archaeology and anthropology often interprets these wheels as representing the wheels of what we might call the chariots of the gods, and these wheels are represented figuratively on many royal thrones to indicate lineage from the first King of Kings. And to say that archaeology, anthropology often does this, I think it's probably safe to say that it nearly always interprets wheels this way, and, well, always, really. In fact, the wheels do not look like this is their function, and in fairness, many of the glyphs were carved before the physical wheel became manifest, and Talbot suggests, I think quite reasonably, that the physical wheel was derived from these cosmic wheels rather than the other way around. We certainly know that the Maya had wheels on toys before they were using them on, you know, to carry things around and stuff. The spokes of the carved wheels often look etheric rather than functional. Best example on the three you've got is the one on the right of those three. Sometimes the cosmic wheel is shown being driven by a rope, and sometimes it's seen atop a static pillar or stairway, which we can see in slide 13. Which does indeed show a couple of discs. One of them is atop a stationary pillar, and the other one is atop what looks like a ladder or a stairway. Actually, in another Thunderbolts project video recorded, I think it was at the Electric Universe conference last year, there are slides showing that as the configuration taken from the discharge through plasma develops, it does become something that looks extremely like a stairway or a ladder. So there's another common biblical metaphor that's been made real by plasma science. Again, you can see pictures of Talbot's reconstruction of that, but here we can see it actually in these old carvings. Note also that the number of streamers or spokes that are coming from the center or hub of the wheel can vary in number and shape. There can be anything from three to loads of them. They might be narrow and pointed, or wide with scalloped tips, straight or wavy. They can be orderly or chaotic. There's all manner of forms in which these wheels present themselves. And Talbot makes a good fist of basically seeing this as a progression of different energy states. These differences across time are interpreted by him as changes in the state of the object that's being witnessed and then represented in the art. If we go to slide 14... you'll see a set of cosmic wheels in one place. These appear to be a set of pictures of planets, immense in the sky and in close and actual conjunction. Perhaps they illustrate the progress over time of these conjunctions. And the precise nature of Saturn's importance in this regard comes when we realise that the cosmic wheels in this image do not represent one planet, but three as viewed from Earth. So when we imagined Saturn standing still above the top of the Egyptian stonework, the Egyptian obelisk, we weren't just looking at Saturn, but in front of Saturn was Venus, and in front of Venus was Mars, as seen from Earth. So if you look at slide 15, we should see a rather lovely graphic production that Talbot's done of just exactly that. You can see the reddish disk of Mars in front. There's actually a slightly larger disk of Venus, as it would be. And from Venus, you can see all of these electrical streamers. There's 8 of them in this particular one. And the big disk around the outside is Saturn. Remember, sitting still and huge in the night and daytime sky of the ancient Earth. So Mars forms the center of the conduction. And with Mars, you know, kind of that close to the Earth and backlit effectively by Venus, I wonder if this, it, could it be from sources with more detailed knowledge of these times that Jonathan Swift managed to extract the information we mentioned last week? Because he published in 1726 in Gulliver's Travels a pretty accurate description of the size and orbital periods of the two tiny moons of Mars, which you can have had no chance of seeing. As I say, the moons may well have been quite visible without lenses, with Mars being that close and backlit as well. If you move on to slide 16, we can see one of the more enigmatic pictures that I'm sure many of you will have seen. It is a picture of the reconstruction of Saturn, Venus and Mars sat next to the wheel of Babylon's sun god called Shamash. I'm sure you all remember, because it was only a few minutes ago, that Shamash is the Assyrian name for Saturn, although they did identify it as Saturn as well. The central star in the Assyrian wheel is called Ishtar, and identified as Venus, and later on became Inanna. All of these names that we keep hearing in all manner of other contexts, shall we say. Contexts, which, as many of you will know, I've made a bit of a special study of in the past. Ishtar, not a goddess, Venus, up there, in physical conjunction in the sky. Saturn represented when heaven was close to the earth. All of these are things that we keep seeing. When heaven was close to the earth, this is, it's thought, the primeval unity that we see discussed and mentioned in classic texts. It is real conjunction. It is known as the motionless superior sun, because all other suns, I guess, have moved a bit more quickly. First in the line of kings, and eventually, in that time, a great disaster some 10,000 years ago, it became the archetype of the dying or displaced god. Venus, the mother goddess, of course, but we can see its eye, heart and soul, a tripartite connection. It's the hub of the wheel and its spokes. That's the mother, that is, the hub of the wheel and the spokes, giving the rest of us the job of rolling along the cobbles. It represented the tree of life, the tree or plant of life. It is, of course, because Mars is in front of it. It is the shield of the warrior god Mars, and it's also his crown in the form of the energetic streamers coming from Venus. It is also the comet, the terrible goddess, Typhon, a flailing monster with 100 fire-breathing heads. And more really resonant images from Mars, which sits at the front, the warrior or hero king from which all future heroes and kings inherit their power, the innermost heart of heart, the child in the womb or on the lap. We've seen a lot of that about the place, haven't we? Associated once again with contexts that appear. That is basically Mars sitting in the lap of Venus. The pupil of the eye. That is another really, really common symbol that we see in all sorts of applications. And once again, this is what it seems to stem from. It stems apparently from Mars standing at the forefront and center of this conjugation. Mars is also known as the slayer of dragons and chaos monsters and the axle of the cosmic wheel. And it was, of course, the slayer of dragons. Venus looked like a dragon, eating its own tail. And there was all those subsidiary discharges and things going on around it as all of its various bits met. And these would have manifested a bit like in the... Was it the Iranian picture of lots and lots of stick figures? I can't remember. The one that's got lots on a rock anyway. That's pretty much what the sky might well have looked like. And in a way, Mars drew all of these from Earth. There was a lot of chaos Earth suffered as a result. But it does occur to me, and I'm not sure that Talbot mentions it, that Mars may have appeared from here on Earth to surrender its life to protect Earth from the comet and the ultra-high energy discharge monsters associated with it. Mars really did take a tremendous electrical thraping whilst interacting with the comet, and it lost much of its surface to space in the process, and maybe lost its water too. But certainly, it's not impossible to take on the belief that Mars gave of its life in order that Earth would survive. And yes, indeed, Ray, I see you put in the idea in the chat box earlier on about the Grand Canyon being electrically carved out of planet Earth. That does indeed seem to be the case, because of course Mars has got one that's over 5,000 kilometers long and four times as deep as the Grand Canyon. And again, this was all put down to water that's long gone and wind and erosion and all these sort of things, but there's absolutely no evidence of water, no evidence of erosion, no evidence of detritus. And the people from the Thunderbolts project have got some very good videos suggesting that in fact what it was sudden electric arc. So that these things didn't generate themselves apparently over thousands or millions of years or whatever. They happened really quite suddenly, and the result would have been a whole load of rocks thrown into space later, I'm sure, to become another person's meteorite. If we look at slide 17, you can see how this idea, this conjunction of these three planets, actually became, in a way, the gods that were then written about, because slide 17 should hopefully show, slide 18, sorry, the conjunction, picture of the conjunction as presented by Talbot, and the glyph or pictograph for An, the elder god of Egypt. And you can see that the thing representing the nominal god looks pretty much like the actual thing that Talbot is proposing was seen in the sky. So we can almost sort of see how the writing there is starting to do its spellish and wicked kind of tricks on us. We can sort of see it actually happening. As we say, the point at which this constellation of stars or planets stood in the sky was static, which meant that you could make an obelisk point at it. Other things could be made to point at it. And if you look at slide 18, you'll see a conjunction of the pyramid. That's the pyramid of the sun, significantly enough, at Teotihuacan in central Mexico. But it does look to me like a giant star cookie. So that's what I put on the caption. But there you go. Once again, remember that would have sat there above the top of that pyramid with the stars of the night sky revolving around it. And as the year went by, the pyramid itself would revolve around the static place. Really, fine thing. And I wonder how many other of these ancient sites that we've had so many bizarre ideas about are there because that's what they were pointing at. Not exactly a down-to-earth explanation, but it is an explanation that makes more sense than many that we've had before. And the Australian astronomer Wallace Thornhill, who you'll see a lot on the Thunderbolts videos, has confirmed that the forms Talbot has reconstructed were electrical. They were plasma discharge streamers stretching between the planets. It seems now quite clear that, as Talbot says, that reconnecting with our forgotten past will be essential, because we're being deeply misled here. So reconnection with our forgotten past will be essential. Essential to our cultural integrity, because we are one culture, we're earthlings. And the number of misunderstandings and suffering and torture and general very bad behaviour that has come about as a result of the misinterpretation of this data have been endless, seemingly endless. It's going to be essential for the study of human consciousness, if nothing more than because of all of the kind of the sublimation and the disassociation and all the things that have come to us. Quite possibly, these people are right, quite possibly, as a direct result of this huge and all-pervasive lie that we've been told. And it's certainly going to be essential for all the sciences, because you know, it's like Rupert Sheldrake says, I mean, these people believe this stuff when they turn up at the office, but he's wondering how many of them actually believe it when they go home. You know, how can you keep saying that we live in a completely neutral universe? So, blimey, look at that. I've I've come to the end of another show, and I haven't managed to make it to the bleeding comments. So, probably, I wonder if we can just whip through a little bit of that, because I would like to do the comet thing, because it is really the kind of coup de grace, as it were. I'm not sure so if I've got any notes on it. Oh, yes, I have. This is another really, really great vid from the Thunderbolts people. I think it was called, again, I'll post some links at the end of the show. It was called Deep Impact Confirming the Electric Comet in YouTube. It was preceded by a couple of vids called The Electric Comet, When Planets Gave Birth to Comets, which is also full of, but this one, Deep Impact Confirming the Electric Comet, is, I think, a 2005 mission from NASA in which they launched this very American project. They launched an 800-pound copper projectile at the nucleus of Comet Tempel 1. And NASA were, as usual, completely surprised by everything they came across, but Thornhill, the Australian astronomer I mentioned earlier, made several detailed predictions about what they were going to find. One of them was that the comet, they were suggesting the comet is not a primordial object left over from the formation of the solar system, which is what orthodoxy would have us believe, that they're made out of basically of primordial dust, slush, and ice. They predicted that electrical stress may short out the electronics on board the impactor, the thing they were shooting at the comet. And indeed that turned out to be case. There was a clear signal for the entire journey, but just before the impactor impacted, the signal was seriously interrupted. The Thunderbolts people, Thornhill, anticipated a lightning-like discharge, a flash in advance of impact, and this is exactly what occurred. NASA's comment on that was, what you see is something really surprising, which I basically stamped that on everything. Why not? Next question, of course, was if it is made up of primordial dust and slush, would the impactor hit slush or a more solid icy object? NASA, of course, not anticipating any kind of electrical component at all. But there was, as predicted, a much bigger explosion than envisioned because of the electrical component of the encounter. The size of the explosion was apparently the greatest surprise not only to NASA but to most of the watching scientists, apart from the guys in the Thunderbolts lab who were probably busy handing over fivers on bets, I'm sure. How did we make such a big splash, they were asking. Well, they should have gone to thunderbolts.info and found out, shouldn't they? That's what I say. Look. How much money are these people spending to stay blind, eh? Well, I don't know. When you see what some committed professionals are doing, it is amazing that you can get away with a con like this, really. All that money to be completely mystified. They expected pretty immediately to look into a deep hole, because, of course, if it's just dust and ice, you expect your 800-pound copper projectile to pierce deeply beneath the skin, don't you? But the explosion was so loud, and they were so large, and there was such a massive cloud of, again, completely unexpected silica dust. It was so expansive that vision was lost pretty much immediately. Luckily, they were keeping an eye from the launch module, because there was a satellite that launched this impactor, and it kept an eye with all sorts of instrumentation on this activity. And there was a quick and very dramatic rise in ultraviolet, which is one of the spectra that was being used to examine it. And that means, by definition, apparently, though once again I can't claim to understand this, but it means that the probe struck a hard surface. You need a temperature greater than 3,000 degrees Fahrenheit to get the ultraviolet emissions that were received by the module. And the initial temperature, because of the tolerances of the equipment on board and the saturation that occurred, must have been greater than or equal to 6,000 degrees Fahrenheit, because it actually saturated their sensors. All of that, much hotter, much bigger than expected, much more silica than expected, and when they got to have a look at it with another thing that they had wandering by a bit later, they found that there wasn't actually much of a hole either. So it definitely did hit something pretty bloody hard. Little or none of the water that was predicted by NASA. They were expecting mostly water. There really wasn't any there. The material that came out was a surprise to scientists, it says. Fine, powdery material. Not much water at all. It was thought that physical heat processes inside comets were responsible for volatile jets that kind of drive them along, as it were, and it was discovered that these weren't actually there. Such jets as there are, which aren't exactly what NASA imagined, were predicted to shift by the Thunderbolts people. They expected that as a result of charge redistribution on the nucleus of the comet after an electrical event, that pretty shortly afterwards the jets would change in intensity and or move. Fortunately, a Nordic optical telescope was watching the whole thing, and it took photographs before and after the event. And it shows, indeed, as predicted by the Thunderbolts people and not by the incredibly expensive NASA, that new jets did come out from completely different places and at a different intensity from the originals. I mean, the Thunderbolts people said that there'd be a sculpted surface, there'd be sharply defined craters and mesas and valleys and ridges, vertical ridges and the rest. None of this would have been expected on a dirty snowball, and all turned out to be true of Temple 1. Nothing observed on the cometary nuclei has contradicted the electric theory. Everything observed on the cometary nuclei has surprised NASA. Why are we putting our money there? And that was 2005, so that's now 8 years ago, and in closing, I'm probably going to run over just a little bit, playing one or two bits of music, but looks like we're going to make it. But in closing, I'd like to come up with the first five definitions of comets that I came at when I did a bit of a search on the internet to see how many people were at the cutting edge, as you all out there now are. Definition one. Didn't make a note of where it came from. It said comets are referred to as dirty snowballs. They're left over from the formation of stars and planets billions of years ago. Definition 2. A comet is an icy small solar system body that, when close enough to the sun, displays a visible coma, a thin, fuzzy, temporary atmosphere. Actually, I think you'd find the Thunderbolts people would say that it's an electrical charge, which is expressing itself as an electrically charged object, travels through the electrical field thrown by the sun. Definition 3 comes from space.com. A comet is an icy body that releases gas or dust. They are often compared to dirty snowballs, though recent research has led some scientists to call them snowy dirt balls. Comets contain dust, ice, carbon dioxide, ammonia, methane and more. Some researchers think comets might originally have brought some of the water and organic molecules to Earth that now make up life here. Well, catch up, guys. Definition 4 came from spaceabout.com. In ancient cultures, comets were seen as omens and were therefore looked upon with reverence and fear. But these beautiful objects are little more than balls of dust. Definition 5 comes from the European Space Agency. Comets are often called dusty snowballs, objects made of ice, rock and organic compounds that originate from a region beyond the orbits of the outermost planets called the Oort cloud. Something I've talked about before. Gravitational perturbations periodically jar these objects out of this cloud, sending them on orbits that can come close to the sun. When comets come in on the inner solar system, the ices in the comet's solid part, called the nucleus, begin to vaporize and form the characteristic beautiful trails that sometimes can be seen from Earth. And I could go on. I mean, apart from the Thunderbolts project people, everybody else is still saying they're icy, dusty snowballs. So the kind of myth, the absolutely comprehensive debunking of a myth that we've been just literally, honestly, folks, just literally skittering over the surface of over the last couple of Dr. Rock shows is still being maintained. Five definitions there, including one from space.com and one from the European Space Agency. I couldn't find a definition of comet on the NASA site, but there it is. Still there, still the same shit. They ain't telling us what's going on. And we can start to see it, and we know, as Rob Menard says. But in my opinion, there's no more faith required, even on first impressions. This looks like real science, validatable on the computer or in the laboratory. And it's science that bears directly It bears directly on the lies and misdirection that are buried in history, buried in theology, and buried in religion. And they've never been more apparent, and never been more apparent that it is tripe and lies as this modern work progresses. I'm going to play another tune, have a quick word with Freeman Jack to see if I can nick 10 or 15 minutes of his show, because I really would like to just have a little return to the Anomalies book and see what it's got to say about the subject of disassociation and sublimation, because that is one of the key points, as well as making clear unclear symbols and debunking fake history and fake science. I think that possibly it is possible that the most important aspect of all of this does lie in the desublimation of the behaviour and the experiences that are leading to our radically unsatisfactory behaviour. So we're going to play another tune. I will be back with you in 5 minutes or so, by the look of it. Last week we heard I Don't Need Religion by Motorhead. Lemmy, being a preacher's son, knows a little bit about it. And this is his definitive song on the nature of religion. It's called Orgasmatron. And another fine lyric from the man, I think. I'll be back with you very shortly. Thanks for being out there, folks. You are, of course, listening to tnsradio.com. And this is Dr. Rock's radio show. And this is Motorhead. Again. Well, we're into injury time here on Dr. Rock's radio show. I hope you've joined me for the last little bit of it, which basically are a few rather interesting thoughts on what are classified in my William Corliss book of peer-reviewed anomalies called Science Frontiers, Some Anomalies and Curiosities of Nature. This particular group of things is called disassociation phenomena, and it includes multiple personality, automatisms, hysteria, hypnotism, and dreams, and has got many useful items in it. But on this occasion, I want to just look at one item he's got on multiple personalities, and on the overview of disassociation phenomena as a whole. He says, by far the most important class of psychic behaviour originates in what is termed disassociation. Disassociative behaviour occurs when normal conscious behaviour is modified, sometimes overwhelmed by subsidiary mental activity. Subsidiary mental activity. A second self seems to control the hand of the automatic writer and the speaker's tongue in glossolalia. On occasion, the secondary personality will take over all bodily activity, and we have cases of multiple personality and possession. Dreams, sleepwalking, fugues, and hypnotism are all manifestations of disassociative behavior in which the waking mind is pushed into the background. Of course, the methods used at the beginning of last week's show were the induction of trauma rather than those other methods. It works just as well. The important anomalous aspects of disassociative behaviour are: 1. The curious, innate susceptibility of the human mind to disassociation phenomena. Susceptibility. 2. The inescapable suspicion that every human mind harbours many other selves residing deep within. And 3. The strong tendency of the human mind to succumb to religious hysteria and exaltation, as well as other all-consuming mindsets, and to theories of what should be in science as well as everyday life. Why do these propensities exist? What evolutionary value do they offer? Are they symptomatic of imperfections in the human makeup, or do they presage an evolutionary leap towards something better, whatever that might be? Well, I, as you know, tend to prefer to believe that they presage an evolutionary leap. Apocalypse is an unveiling. Unveiling is what is going on here. And those three things, the susceptibility of the human mind to disassociation phenomena, the suggestion that every human mind harbours other selves residing deep within, and the tendency of the human mind to succumb to religious hysteria and exaltation, are all things that we have directly seen played upon in the last 6 hours or so of chatter that's come from this show. And it's difficult for those of us who don't have necessarily haven't noticed our multiple personality disorder. I suspect we've all got them. But it is incredibly powerful. And here's a little article that came from the New York Times in 1988. And it says, the multiple personalities of individuals afflicted with this disorder are sharply defined. Each personality has its, his or her, distinctive handwriting, artistic talents, foreign language capabilities, and other aspects of behaviour, all in the same body. Such mental and behavioural facets of multiple personality are well recognised, even if not understood. Well, I think some people understand them, guys. What is even stranger and more anomalous about multiple personality is the remarkable mind-body relationship manifested. Consider, for example, the case of Timmy. When Timmy drinks orange juice, he has no problem, and this is a quote. But Timmy is just one of close to a dozen personalities who alternate control over a patient with multiple personality disorder. And if those other personalities drink orange juice, the result is a case of hives. The hives will occur even if Timmy drinks orange juice and another personality appears while the juice is still being digested. What's more, if Timmy comes back while the allergic reaction is present, the itching of the hives will cease immediately and the water-filled blisters will begin to subside. Well, what I'm hoping we're seeing here is the reawakening of our Timmy, which will bloody chase away the severe case of bloody hives that we've got as a race. How does one explain such phenomena? We cannot, obviously, at least not yet. What the phenomenon of multiple personality does do is to offer us a window for observing that mysterious interface between one's thoughts and bodily functions. Perhaps, if we can heal the mind, we can also heal the body. And that's, as I say, probing the enigma of multiple personalities from the New York Times. And then there's another little section in Multiple Personalities that says, is titled Different Personalities, Different Brainwaves. Psychologists have always wondered how a single brain could harbour several personalities, as is the situation in the so-called multiple personality disorder. Are the different personalities really separate physiologically? Are they faked? Psychological testing at the separate personalities conducted at different times, when each personality was in charge, seemed to indicate discrete personalities, even though one personality might know of the existence of one or more of the others in the same brain. Brainwave tests were even more conclusive. Each personality had its own distinct set of brainwaves in response to identical stimuli. In effect, the brain was operating in a different mode for each personality. And we know, although we haven't touched on it, we've covered so much of this subject in the last couple of weeks, but we haven't actually touched on the physical, energetic, electrical interference with the actual brainwaves themselves, though, again, it appears to be pretty certain that that is possible, doable, and, alas, for sure, being done. A comment that Corliss puts on that last one says, could the ability of the brain to operate in different modes be turned into an asset rather than an affliction? I think, could it be turned into an asset for us rather than an asset for whoever, might be the pertinent question. After all, computers can be made more effective when they execute several programs at once. So, there you go. Disassociative behaviour. We're clearly being driven to it. We clearly have a penchant for it. And clearly, taking ownership of it for ourselves is going to be presumably a good deal more practical and useful to us than allowing others to have possession of it and consent to use it. Because I'm sure that perhaps if we're withdrawing the consent to use one, we can work on withdrawing the consent to use any of them, and we can use them ourselves. And like some character says here, they say that a woman with MPD who made a claim of having multiple disorders said that people with multiple disorders have boundless energy because some of the personalities can sleep while others work. Brilliant.